Now, stay tuned. We got the second hour of the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show right here on KSCO. Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the show. It was my brother Wayne's birthday last week, and we wanted to do something special. So he and my brother Norm went on a little field trip to check out one of our Boulder Creek neighborhoods that had been devastated by the CZU Lightning Complex wildfire this last summer. We drove up to the Pinecrest area, not far from Big Basin Vineyards, where my friend Bradley Brown had lost his beautiful home in the fires. And in that Pinecrest neighborhood, we were stunned to find that it looked what I always imagined a nuclear blast could do. Buildings completely leveled, nothing but ash and debris that was once somebody's precious belongings. While we were exploring the area and looking at the way the fire had burned through the trees, we were intercepted by a guy in a big truck asking what we were doing there, assuming that we were some looky-loos here to check out the sites, or in this case, lack of sites, just rubble. After assuring the driver that we were not the droids that he thought we were, we found out that he was a local who had lost his beautiful home and belongings. And before long, a couple of other locals arrived, and my brothers and I had an opportunity to find out more exactly how it all came down in that neighborhood and how the residents and the authorities have been dealing with this profound local disaster. It's quite a story. It has a lot of implications, especially for those of us that live in fire-threatened neighborhoods. So I thought I'd share a little bit of that with you. So our guest today is Jeff Peters, a software engineer who had lived in his dream home there with his family for 21 years. Welcome to the show, Jeff. Thanks for your time and really sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So let's start at the beginning. How were you first aware that there was a serious fire threat happening?
Well, so the fire started because of the lightning storm that had happened the Sunday before. We were aware that there was a fire that had begun and was slowly moving its way from the coast, you know, inward and northward. And so that was on Sunday. So by Tuesday, you know, we could see some signs of the smoke and stuff. We couldn't see any flames or anything yet, but we could see that there was definitely big clouds of smoke. And of course, it was on the news every night, and they were talking about, oh, yeah, it's merged together and become a bigger fire, and they don't know where it's going, but it's heading here at this point. And
did you see the lightning storm that Sunday night? Did you watch that?
Oh, yeah, that was unbelievably spectacular. I'm originally from Chicago, and we're used to lightning like that, but never have I seen lightning like that out here.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It kept us in awe for hours.
But you had seen it in Chicago. I had never heard anybody who saw lightning like that before either. It was so weird.
Well, yeah, I mean, lightning like that is common in the Midwest, and we'd see that all the time in Chicago, but that would always come with water and rain and never really burned anything up.
Yeah, did you worry at that point at all?
I was a little concerned because I couldn't tell how far off the coast it was, or how, you know, if it was on land or not, you know, and the news report said that, well, it's likely to hit on land in a few spots, but we couldn't tell. We could just see the spectacular light show. Yeah. And we didn't know exactly where they were landing. And then later on we heard, oh, yeah, there's a few spot fires. It sounded like they had things under control.
Mm. So on the timeline, that was Sunday night. And then you started seeing some smoke Tuesday. Is that what you said?
Yeah, we might have been able to see some of it before that, but it wasn't really, you know, nearby and heading in our direction. But by Tuesday, we could see there was a fair amount of smoke that, it just started getting, bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
And at one point we decided, we better go see what's going on, see if we can see how big this is getting, because we can't tell exactly where it's moving yet. And so we went up to the ridge that was behind our neighborhood here, about 1400 feet, and from that ridge you can see all the way across the 236 valley all the way to the other gigantic mountain, which is probably got to be at least 2000 feet tall there. That's part of Big Basin Redwood State Park. And we could see the smoke was definitely coming up from the other side of that mountain, but still no flames yet.
Any winds?
the wind was blowing a little, but it wasn't too bad. We couldn't see any flames yet, so we really couldn't get a handle on how big it was, yeah. Other than just the fact that it's moving in some direction. The news keeps talking to us about it, and so...
So anyway. You knew something was happening, but you weren't too worried just yet.
Yeah, we absolutely were not worried yet. Until, yeah. All of a sudden, in the afternoon on Tuesday, or late afternoon, I guess it was, like 3 or 4 o'clock, something like that, All of a sudden we hear a helicopter flying overhead. So this helicopter's flying around, and it looked like it was over in the 236 Valley. And all of a sudden we noticed that it's a CHP helicopter, and it's got its loudspeaker on, and it's blaring out some sort of a saying, I couldn't quite catch what it was until it got a little bit closer.
Yeah.
And then I could hear what they were saying. They were saying, the fire's coming, evacuate now. This entire area is being evacuated. And that was sort of the first we heard about how dangerous this could potentially get.
So did you check the news? Did you check the fire department at that point, or what did you do?
Well, we did check the news. Nothing really had been said. We figured that if they were really evacuating us, they'd give us a, you know, reverse 911 call or something like that. So we couldn't find any information about much of anything right at that moment. We did find some stuff later on Facebook shortly thereafter that said that, yeah, they're planning on trying to evacuate this area. But at the moment, I was thinking, oh, they must be talking about the 236 Valley, because the fire isn't even in that valley yet. It's west of there. So if it's coming this way, it's going to hit that valley first. So they must be talking about that. But then the copter flew directly over us all the way over to Highway 9 and told everybody in Pinecrest and Riverside Grove and everyone was to evacuate immediately.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how much time did you have to pack?
So we immediately started throwing stuff together and getting stuff out of the house, packed up the wife, the kids, the dogs, everything that we needed, and said, all right, we've got all that done for a super urgent withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I said, well, okay, let's go see how bad this is, right? Because if it still hasn't entered the 236 Valley, it's going to be a long time before it gets over to us. So we got everything packed up, sent the wife and kids and dogs away, and me and one of the other neighbors nearby here, we decided, well, let's go up on the ridge and let's just park ourselves up there and see what this is looking like. And at that point, there was still no flames visible. Every once in a while, we could just barely see maybe a little tiny tinge of the tip of a flame from the opposite side, from the west side of that mountain.
Mm-hmm. And what was the time at this point?
Well, this is probably late afternoon, probably like 5 o'clock at this point.
On Wednesday?
And Tuesday.
Tuesday, yeah. Okay.
Right. And so we decided, okay, well, we're not leaving yet. There's no sign of any flames yet. And so we decided to stay up there, and we spent the entire night up on that ridge. A couple hours later, we were very easily able to see the flames. They finally did crest that ridge on Big Basin State Park.
I'll say something. And that happened Tuesday night. Listen, put a bookmark right there? We're going to go to a commercial break. We'll be right back. We're talking to Jeff Peters about the CZU fire and what happened in a devastated neighborhood in Boulder Creek. Welcome back to the show. We're talking to Jeff Peters, who was there in the middle of this incredible CZU lightning fire this last August in Boulder Creek and the surrounding areas. Now, Jeff, let's go back to that moment when you started to see the fire, the moment when you started to get really worried. What did you see at that point?
Well, actually, we first saw the fire, you know, Tuesday evening when it finally crested over the top of that ridge that's west of us, which is in Big Basin State Park. Mm-hmm. And we watched it all night long. We stayed up there and kept an eye on it. We could see some of the fire crews that were working on it overnight. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't any aircraft flying at night, of course. But we could see where the fire was going, and it was unbelievably spectacular. I mean, in some situations, we could see when it would move into an area and it completely engulf a small little grove of trees and just explode out of there. Must have been 500-foot flames easily.
I mean, like trees exploding?
Yeah, there were trees exploding. There were propane tanks exploding. There was all kinds of things going on. But that was at least a good mile and a half away from us across that valley. So we weren't too concerned at that point because we knew it had to get all the way through the valley and come over to us before we'd have to really get concerned.
Yeah, still and, quite a distance. And we,
yeah, and we stayed up all night watching that. And, you know, early Wednesday morning, we saw, I think eventually some aircraft did start flying and working on it. But the wind had changed a little bit, and it was starting to blow to the south, which from our point of view in our neighborhood was good news. Not good news for the town, of course, right. Or the golf course.
Yeah.
But from our area, we thought, okay, maybe it's not coming here. So we went off and did a few other things, grabbed a few other things out of the house, last-minute stuff, tried to get as much stuff as we could because we didn't know where this was going to go and whether we really were going to need to leave. Our plan was to spend Wednesday night up there again and keep an eye on it just to see if it was going to actually come into the neighborhood.
Mm. Were you doing any precautions for your house, like putting water on the roof or anything like that? Or?
No, power was out. We had our generators running. Mm. We had our 10,000-gallon water system tank that had water in it that's connected to some of the hydrants. But we didn't really have the ability to, we didn't have any big pumps or anything like that. Yeah. I mean, all we had was garden hose trickling and that sort of stuff. And honestly, at this point, we really did not think it was coming into the neighborhood, right? Because we hadn't left yet. Most of the neighborhood had. We decided we were going to stick it out until, you know, we couldn't stay any longer.
Right.
So,
right.
And we planned on doing that. About Wednesday evening, though, when we went up there again to check things out, it had gotten really smoky. The wind, I guess, had shifted again and started to come east towards us. But the problem was it got really, really thick, and we could no longer see the fire across the valley anymore. And we thought, you know what, this is a little bit too dangerous to stay up here, and the smoke was really, really bad. We were thinking if we were going to stay up here again, we'd have to stay in our houses, you know, with the windows and doors closed, but without any visibility to where the flames were, that was a little bit too risky. So we left and evacuated that night.
So it was really the smoke that really got convinced you that this was the time.
It was the thickness of the smoke and the lack of visibility to know where the flames actually were moving.
Oh, okay.
And that's what booted us out. And we left Wednesday night, told a couple of the neighbors who were still in the neighborhood, said, all right, we're leaving. We can't keep an eye out for this stuff for you anymore.
Oh, by the way, did you have any bandwidth at this point or any cell phone? What was the communications like?
No, the cell phones were down to almost nothing. All the data had dried up. There was just barely voice communication on cell. You know, all the Comcast stuff had stopped at this point. Okay. Anyhow, so we left Wednesday night, and I got a call early Thursday morning, like 5 a.m., from one of the neighbors that was still here who frantically was saying, okay, we're leaving. We can see it coming over the ridge, and it's coming down towards Pinecrest. And I'm like, oh, crud. So I hurried up and got my stuff together and came back because I wanted to see how close it was and what was happening. You know, and I was easily able to drive in because the fire had not come through this neighborhood yet. Mm. So I got here probably around 8 o'clock in the morning or so, and came driving up Pinecrest, and there was a lot of evidence of charred debris that had been floating through the air, like whole leaves completely charred, just laying in the ground on the road. I'm like, oh, that's not good.
Those are like what they call embers, huh?
Yeah, these are the burnt out embers of stuff that had flown for a long, long time, and they were completely burned, right? So like these things were totally on fire as they were flying through the air.
Wow.
And so as I was coming up, I noticed about a third of the way up Pinecrest, there was a house there on the side that had a grass fire going in its front yard. I'm like, oh, that's not good. All right. So let me go on up and see if I can get some of my buddies and maybe we can come down there and fight it with a garden hose or whatever. So I went up there, talked to one of the neighbors, sent him down. He went down to try to knock it down with the garden hose and was loosely successful with that. There wasn't a whole lot of water pressure there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he noticed that not only was the grass on fire, but the entire forest behind the house was completely engulfed.
Oh, man.
And he's like, all right, well, this hose is not big enough. So he called 911, called the Boulder Creek fire guys to come on up. They came on up, took a look at it, and eventually said, no, this is just out of control. There's nothing we can do here. They were going to try to put the house out, but it was going too far.
Hmm. And this was his house at this point?
This was the house that was about a third of the way up Pinecrest.
Okay, his house then. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, right.
Wow. And as far as you know, how did it go from house to house in the neighborhood? Was it the embers or?
Yeah. So what we think was, well, we could see that it had slowly crept over our ridge and was just slowly creeping down the ridge. Nice and easily manageable, you know, assuming you had water or a couple of fire engines or something.
Yeah.
But the problem was these floating embers that were coming over from the big part of the fire that I guess when it was going up the backside of the hill and raging up there, it would make these embers and they would fly way, way, way down. And that's what happened. These embers flew all the way down almost to the bottom of Pinecrest, caught the forest there on fire, and it just roared up the hill, gobbling up all of our houses along the way.
Because you were on the uphill. Yeah, so, but the embers came down to the bottom of the hill, and they started it at the bottom, and it went up. Wow.
Huh. Right.
Very, very intense. We have a caller, Mrs. Future?
We do.
Are you willing to take a call, Jeff, at this point?
Certainly.
Yeah, okay.
Let's say hello to Mark and Ben Lomond. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Say, that's a really interesting program you have here, right?
Yeah.
We had it pretty easy. We had to evacuate from Felton, but even that was kind of hairy for us, even as far away we were when it finally got all said and done.
Yeah. You have a question for Jeff?
One more question is, what do you think, well, I'm going to make a comment too, but what do you think when there's an evacuation order, like get out of the house now and get out of here immediately, is that actually stated because the fire is so close you're about ready to burn down? And it's an immediate threat, or is it said because they want people out of their homes, get out of the high roads, and so they don't clog up the roads if they wait too long, so the fire department can have access, In other words, maybe it's just to get everybody out to the room to move in the firefighters. Yeah.
So what do you think, Jeff?
What is it?
How did you interpret the evacuation commands?
Well, at the time, I had always thought that they were going to send out those types of evacuations, especially flying a helicopter over to tell us about it, if it was like licking at our heels and we needed to bug out of town fast. Hmm. But when we went up there and looked and like couldn't find any flames whatsoever at that point, and the fire actually didn't even arrive for another 2 days, it seemed like it was, well, that sort of level of evacuation seemed a little bit premature. But we have since spoken to the Boulder Creek fire chief, who explained how all that stuff works. And he's the one who called for the evacuation at that point. And the problem was that he was looking at which way the fire was moving and how many people were in the area and all the choke points along there and how he was possibly going to get all of these people out of this area in time to be out of the way for the flames and still have fire equipment coming in to help fight the fire.
Right.
And so that's why he pulled the trigger early.
Yeah, because you need the time in order to do all that.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was just thinking as an individual, like, gosh, if I had another hour, to unload some of the precious stuff from the house, it'd be so much better.
The more time you have, the better.
I had a car that's full of stuff, and I had a friend coming up, and he's going to come to the house. We weren't too far away from Felton, and he's going to come get my car, and his wife's going to drive the other car out of there. But they got blockaded by the sheriff, so they couldn't come to our house or... And we had just left, in our cars. But he couldn't get my other car to take all my stuff out, so I had to leave it there in the driveway.
Yeah, well, so, you had to leave a car too, Jeff, right? You couldn't take all your cars, I gather.
Yeah, we had to leave a pickup truck. We couldn't get it out in time.
But the sheriff didn't block anybody from helping you. He was just like, if you had a friend who could have driven it,
As the logistics are complicated in these situations, sure.
Well, and I know we did a neighborhood fire drill with a Cal Fire the year before all this happened, and they said their concern is that if people will evacuate, their first priority is saving lives and their second priority is saving property. And so at the level of the management, they have to get as many people clear of the fire as possible so that they avoid as many emergency rescues as possible.
Hey, Jeff, can you hold on for another segment? Because I'd love to get more info on how the Cal Fire response was and the Boulder Creek Fire Department how to prepare for these in the future.
Thanks,
Mark.
I'm
going
to hang up.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Appreciate your call.
Bye.
And we'll be back right after this little break with Dr. Future Show and our local fire guest, Jeff. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking to Jeff Peters, a software engineer who lost his home in the CZU fire in Boulder Creek. We got a text in wondering, Jeff, how many ways out did you have of being on the top of a ridge like that? And would a walkie-talkie have helped?
Well, actually, that is a good question. So we did have a couple ways out. So there was the main road in. I mean, this is technically a dead-end street that we live on here. Uh-huh. But we do have another way out the back, which is actually through a locked gate and up over through your friend's vineyard.
Bradley Brown's vineyard, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we actually had to leave that way because there was too much fire down, going back down Pinecrest, and there was at least one fire truck there and another one on the way. So we figured, all right, we got to go out the back way. And so we had a set of bolt cutters. We cut the chain and we skedaddled out that way through Waterman Gap Loop. We actually couldn't even go out through Memory Lane, which is the normal way out through there.
That was in flames too, right? Down below.
Yeah, the fire was down there. And actually, as we passed Bradley's house, we noticed a Cal Fire truck that was sitting there in his driveway. And I thought, oh, well, it's good to be the big vineyard owner, have your own personal fire department. But it turns out they were just staging there. And we told them all about what was happening in our neighborhood as we were leaving, that there was one house on fire and a couple others potentially, you know, very close and about to ignite. And they said, well, all right, but they had to go off and do their rounds further down on Memory Lane, and so they weren't able to go in there.
So their buffers were full, so to speak. They didn't really have any action plan for you.
They did not. And it turns out that I don't know if Cal Fire ever did show up in there. I've heard stories from some other folks that maybe there was at least one or two engines in there. Boulder Creek Fire did come up and put some water on a couple of structures, and they saved at least two houses and another outbuilding. And we talked to the Boulder Creek Fire Chief after that, and he said, yeah, their guys were there for as long as they could until it was just too dangerous for them to stay there. Out of the 30 houses that we have up here on Pinecrest and Wildberry and Fossil, all of them except three are burned to nothing.
Wow.
Right? And the fire department saved two of those.
Hmm. If you said the fire department was right next to Bradley's house, and it wasn't saved, though. How did that happen? Was it already burned by the time you were there?
It was perfectly fine as we were leaving, and as Cal Fire was pulling out of his driveway, they had to go down to Memory Lane to handle some other fire down there.
At the bottom of his property.
Yeah, and I don't know why they weren't able to save his place, but it's pretty sad. I went by there afterwards and noticed how bad it was there.
Yeah, it was. It was completely devastated, like your neighborhood.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So what did you do at that point? Did you have plans to have friends to stay with?
Yeah, we actually evacuated initially to Scotts Valley to some friends there, and then it turns out they had to evacuate.
That's
so
right. Just a couple
there.
Days later, right?
Right. And so that next day, we're like, oh, okay. Well, they're leaving too, so we got to leave Scotts Valley. So we ended up going as far east as we could, and ended up out in Watsonville at the Motel 6 there, because that was the only motel we could find that would accept two dogs, because we had animals, and you know, there's most of the motels will take one dog, but very few of them will take two. So we ended up out there.
Yeah.
And it turns out there was like four or five other folks from the neighborhood who were also staying there. So it was sort of like a little Pinecrest reunion.
Yeah. And it was Watsonville where we got our mail for Boulder Creek for a while after that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you got to keep in mind that Cal Fire had originally decided that the only way they could stop this fire was to have a giant fire break, and they were going to use Highway 17 for that. We heard that from the fire captain in Boulder Creek, and even a couple of previous fire captains had told us that they had heard that from Cal Fire, that their initial line of attack was going to be abandon everything, let everything burn up to Highway 17, and that's where we'll stop the fire.
Yes, I heard that. Was that true? I mean, because I heard 17, that would have included my neighborhood on the other side of Highway 9.
Yeah, that would have consumed everything in Boulder Creek, everything in San Lorenzo Valley, everything in Ziani, everything in Scotts Valley, all the way up to Highway 17, which is absolute insanity.
Wow.
But that's what Cal Fire's plan was.
Wow.
And of course, the Boulder Creek guys said, no, we're not having any of that. We're stopping it at Highway 9 no matter what.
Yeah, they held the line at Highway 9. Yeah, that was the Boulder Creek Fire Department. And did they work with Ben Lomond and Felton as a unit, or were those separate?
No, I believe they were all in it together. And eventually, Cal Fire did seem to come around. Boulder Creek fire captain was telling us, you know, the way that all that stuff works is when all these agencies are working together, they've, you know, got this master plan or whatever that Cal Fire runs. In any case, they eventually realized that they would be able to hold it at Highway 9, and eventually they got some equipment in here. But I think Cal Fire was woefully unprepared for this. Now, I understand that our fire was scheduled during the time that there were several other fires going on in the state, and so they were spread pretty thin.
Yeah, but, like, you didn't see any air support, for example.
There was very little. There was, you know, I think there was one helicopter. I think actually one of them even crashed, if I remember that correctly.
The first fatality among the firefighters was the helicopter pilot.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I think that may have put a damper on things. They didn't want to send too much more aircraft out there, but I think they could have been hitting this thing from the air more, assuming they had the equipment. I've even spoken to some military friends of mine who said, you know what, the military guys, they train for doing this same sort of thing at night. There's no reason at all that our fire crews, our airborne fire crews, can't do that same kind of training and knock this thing down at night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't do it at all at night, do they?
They do not fly at all at night, and that's, they say that because it's for safety reasons. They can't tell where they are. Well, if the military can do it, and when people are shooting at you, I'm pretty sure that Cal Fire could learn how to fly at night with special instruments and all that sort of thing and not crash.
Yeah, that would be a good place for our tax dollars to go.
Absolutely.
Night flying for the fire, especially if they're getting worse and worse like this.
Yeah, well, 2020 hindsight, I believe at the time they said the issue was the smoke and the visibility, because the entire ability for the helicopters to hit it with fire is seeing where they have to aim. They were saying that they didn't have the tools to figure out where to drop the water without visibility.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think all they need to do is ask the military. They have that stuff figured out already.
Yeah, right. Yeah, a little better communications with the military sounds like a good idea. We got another caller, Mrs. Future?
Yeah, we do. Let's say hello to Michael in Santa Cruz. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for accepting my call. The last person who spoke about the military, it was right on. I feel so sad for all the people that have all these houses and burnings and what have you.
Yeah.
But I tell you, I am no expert, but I saw a fire to the internet in Chile, in South America, and they could not stop it. And you got the mountains way bigger than here, and it was fierce, a horrific fire, you know. It was almost burning half of the country.
Wow.
So the Russians sent an airplane. It was a huge, huge plane. It had like three or four swimming pools in there, water, and the fire was gone. It was gone, you know. So I said, oh, wow, Russia has this, and we don't have this in California, you know. And fires are every year the same way. I couldn't believe it. So the guy who said that about the military, he is absolutely right. People can fly anytime, anywhere. We can drop bombs, you know, in the worst conditions here.
We can drop bombs. We can drop water.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So we should be using it on our friends, not our enemies.
Well, we should use
it.
Yeah, for our benefit.
We can afford to have maybe 10, 247 or whatever, the huge airplane, you know, have it ready set up in California. This is too much. It's too much. Well, you know? Yeah, I tell you, it's very possible.
Yeah.
Thank you for accepting my call.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And Brother Norm chimes in. He says, why not give the military some practice then?
You want to keep taking calls? We have more callers.
Jeff, you want to take another caller?
Certainly.
Okay.
Let's say hello to Sean in Live Oak. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Sean. Oh, you got a question for Jeff?
Yeah. Well, I heard his earlier commentary, and it sounds a lot like what I called to tell you about is what we could do with aerial firefighting that we're not doing.
That's right. Didn't you have a suggestion, though, that we could get a bunch of old water bombers that are basically mothballed, and we could bring them back, military machines that could be useful in this day and age? Yeah. We could do a lot more for that, for sure.
You still have that article that I sent you on that?
I do, yeah. I do. Well, it's in our links page.
Yeah, maybe email the guest.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Is he still there?
Yes. Jeff, we got a question for you from Sean.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, this was an article that I sent. It's the old Navy flying boats. They retired them into Vancouver. The Vancouver Firefighting District uses these. And each one of these bombers of water planes drops 30,000 gallons of water over 2 or 3 acres.
That sounds great.
Yeah, we should have them.
I don't see any reason at all why we couldn't have 3 or 4 of those things parked in mothball fleet in Watsonville Airport. I don't know how long it takes to fill one of those up. Maybe they can stay filled while they're sitting there not in use. And then, you know, I'm sure there's going to be plenty of pilots nearby that, you know, retired pilots or whatever, that would be willing to fly one of those and drop some water on the problems.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing is, when you were talking, there was this discussion why the helicopters couldn't fly at night. And I also sent a few articles, but you have the nighttime thermal sights and
yeah, that's all doable now. It's something we could be doing.
Yeah. Actually, there's drones that they use that use infrared cameras, so they can spot where the flames are in the
yes. Yes. Yeah, there's a company, I think it was called Parallel, that's in Scotts Valley, that makes firefighting drones now with the FLIR devices on board. All that stuff's just coming online, and it kind of makes sense, because if we're going to get serious about the virus, we should get serious about our wildfires, too.
Yeah. Well, it's just the thing that struck me about this whole fire is just like, okay, I could see us being somewhat unprepared, but I'm not so much anymore after we already had the Paradise fire. Mm. Yeah. Now we've got this one, and I just don't see us making any headway on the equipment that we need.
Yeah. Okay, well, I guess it takes a disaster to get the headway sometimes. Sadly, that's what we had.
Well, where are the levers, right? I mean, who is it that needs to talk to each other to shift the focus?
Well, the budgets, if you will.
Well, this is a statewide budget. The things that I'm describing are beyond, say, like local fire districts.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, Jeff, can you stay on till 4? Because we've got a couple other questions coming in for you, and I want to hear about the aftermath with how the insurance companies handled it, stuff like that.
Okay, certainly.
Okay.
Thanks, Sean. Always good to hear from
you. Thanks, Sean. Appreciate your call. Okay, we'll be right back. We're talking to Jeff Peters, who survived the CZU fire, but not his house. Welcome back to the show. We were just talking to Jeff Peters about the CZU fire and how his neighborhood was completely incinerated by the fire. We have a question for you. What was left standing on your property?
Well, we came back the next day after the fire. A neighbor of mine and I, we managed to get in. The highway patrol hadn't really locked things down yet. Mm. And we were able to get in there to see how bad the damage was. And it was an absolute war zone. There was telephone poles that had fallen down, burnt in half and fallen over. Mm. We couldn't even drive all the way up Pinecrest. We basically had a park right near that guy's house where everything started. Mm-hmm. And walk ourselves all the way up. You know, it's a pretty good hike.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was very, very thick and smoky still, and things were still on fire all over the place, you know, smoldering piles of rubble.
Wow.
But the thing that we noticed was that everything was gone that had been made out of wood. So the only thing that was left were things that were made out of metal, mostly steel, because even all the aluminum and brass and copper, all that melted.
Yeah, I remember showing me your Liberty gun safe was still standing. That was impressive.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation there about what we learned about gun safes and what to do with them. But so real quick, basically everything that was wood was gone.
Yeah.
Right? Anything that was metal was laying down on top of a layer of white ash, which is all that was left of anything that was wood or plastic.
Wow.
You know, anything that was concrete, of course, the foundations were still there. And I had a concrete shop building that was next to the house, and that survived, thankfully, only because it was made out of concrete. It got very heavily scorched and a bunch of spalling on the outside surface, but everything inside was completely intact. I was very thankful for that.
Yeah, that's great. How about the road itself, Pinecrest Drive?
The road itself, for the most part, has done pretty well. We had just gotten it re-slurried a few months earlier. There were a couple of spots, however, where we have some retaining walls holding up the hillside, and they had wooden timbers in there, and quite a few of those have burned away. And so we've got some problems there that we're trying to get FEMA to help us fix. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah. I noticed your water tanks, you had plastic water tanks. Now, San Lorenzo Valley Water District lost a lot of water because they had plastic tanks. Now, it was interesting how it burned. I thought a full tank, from what I could see, it was burning just from the top, and it slowly burned down, letting water out as it burned down, and creating mostly a flow of plastic that looked like a waterfall going down your property.
It was very interesting. I had a couple of 5,000-gallon tanks. A neighbor of mine had, I think, three or four of those, and they were all full to the top. and they all melted down to nothing and let all their water out, but not catastrophically. You know, it would just trickle the water out as the top of it would melt and get a little lower, and a little more water would leak out, and it would get a little emptier, and then a little more would melt.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. Are there any surprises as to what did survive?
Well, okay, so you mentioned the gun safe. So
yes.
We learned quite a bit.
Did your gun still work, for example?
Well, okay, so several of us were able to get some of the guns out before we evacuated, but others, when CHP flies over the top of you and tells you to get out now, you grab a couple of things and you leave, right? And we had a couple of neighbors who did exactly that, leaving everything there that, you know, was precious to them, including all the guns in their gun safe, which, granted, we had pretty high-end gun safes, fire-rated and everything.
Yeah.
But what we learned was, if you're going to have a gun safe, the number one rule is, don't put ammunition in that gun safe with your guns and your paperwork.
Don't put the ammo in with the guns. That should be separate.
Right. Huh? Yeah, exactly. Don't put the explosive stuff in with the stuff you don't want to burn. The other thing is, placement of that gun safe is absolutely critical. Oh. So I actually had two safes. The one that I showed you that was bolted down to the concrete slab in the garage. It's a detached garage.
Yes.
Right? So the garage is detached from the house, so theoretically wouldn't burn quite as hot as the house would. Doesn't have as much flammable stuff around it as the house does.
Yeah.
And it was bolted to the cement floor. So it did not fall over when everything came crashing down. And that was one of the things that I think saved my safe.
Not falling
over. I had
over.
Another safe. Yeah, exactly. I had another safe that was in the house, and it fell over, and everything inside cooked. There was really nothing left. We did have a few pieces of jewelry, you know, some gold and stuff like that that did survive. My wife actually found her wedding ring in there.
Oh,
later on, we went back and did some sifting, and she found that. So that was wonderful.
What about papers? What about documents?
Right. So of the safes that fell over, all papers were gone. Of the safe that stood up, the one I had bolted down, all my papers were fine. I had some plastic containers that were holding it, and some of those were a little bit warped. Clearly, it got very, very warm in there, but not hot enough to burn the papers. And so I was very thankful for that, too.
Wow. Now, what is it about the safe falling over that destroys everything? Is it dissipation of the heat or what?
Yeah, I think so. These safes, when they build them, they're rated for fire, but only if they're still upright and if a standard house burns down around it, right? So the one that I had in the garage, that was a Liberty safe Lincoln model, and it was pretty high-end at the time when I bought it about 12 years ago or whenever.
Yeah.
And I had it bolted down there, right? So it's designed to withstand the most heat from the front where the locking mechanism is, right? Because it's extra thick there to prevent burglars from getting in.
Right.
And it's okay on the top, but even if you have a burning log or part of your house fall on top of it, it might heat up the top of that safe, but the stuff that's at the bottom of the safe is not likely to heat up, especially if it's bolted to a nice cold concrete slab. As soon as it falls over, you have hot embers cooking the thing all around from all sides and for usually a much longer time.
It's like an oven at that point, huh?
Exactly.
Hmm. And did you have any propane tanks that exploded?
Yeah, so we had a couple of barbecue bottle-sized tanks. Almost all of them survived, and their emergency vent vented all the gas out. But there was one that ripped itself apart, and I think it was contained inside of the barbecue itself because I didn't notice it at the time. And it wasn't until the EPA guys came through looking for nasty things until I found, and they found all the propane tanks, and they pulled that one out, and it had been peeled open like a grape, you know, right at the seam there.
Yeah, I saw that. It was impressive. Now, you said EPA was there. Now, what were they looking for?
So the county sent out the EPA to do this two-phase cleanup. And the first phase is what they had come out to do. And they were basically looking to identify hazardous stuff that was still there after the fire. Mostly asbestos and aerosol bottles and paint, stuff that didn't completely get consumed. I mean, this fire was so hot that everything like that was completely consumed.
Mm.
There were a few cases where they thought there might be some asbestos, like in the fire steel around the fireplace and that sort of stuff. I don't think any of that had asbestos in it because our place was probably new enough.
Because I noticed your fireplaces and the safe had big X's on them. That was put on by the FBI. That was for asbestos, huh?
Hmm. Yeah, it was for possible asbestos. And when the phase two crew comes here, they'll look at that stuff and they'll say, oh, yeah, they'll test it right there on site. And if it's not asbestos, then they say, okay, it's good to go. If it is, then they got to seal it up in plastic and take it to someplace. I don't even know where they take that stuff.
Oh, got a question in. Who pays for the cleanup?
Well, that's a very good question. So the county has instituted a plan where everybody that's in the burn zone is required to pick one of three options, and that is a private cleanup where you can use your insurance money dedicated for cleaning up the debris removal and all that, and hire a contractor to come in and do all that stuff. And some people have chosen that, although it can be fairly expensive. Most people's insurance don't necessarily have all the right amount of coverage needed for this sort of thing.
Is there a free option?
The second option is there's a free option where all you have to do is fill out a huge amount of paperwork and grant them access to your property, and also indicate that you'll give them this remaining cleanup money from your insurance policy, and then they'll come in and cover the entire thing no matter how much it costs. And most of the people in this area have chosen that option, and that option is supposed to start in a couple of weeks now.
And they'll literally haul everything away. Wow.
Exactly.
I remember looking for your hard drives. We didn't have much luck.
No, I think they all completely melted. That fire was really hot there. In my office, I had all kinds of, I guess, flammable stuff. Lots of books and things, lots of, you know, wood and stuff. And so it must have been crazy hot inside there. And, you know, we found a couple of circuit boards from this or from that. I found an old ham radio of mine that the metal husk had survived, but nothing else. That no hard drives at all. So I had about 20 or 30 old hard drives sitting there waiting for me to bulk erase and take to the dump. So I guess the fire took care of that for me.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about that anymore. Jeez.
Yeah.
We're getting very close to the end of the show.
Oh, okay. Yes, yeah. Okay, in the final couple minutes, Jeff, what future changes would you like to see happen? Like, for example, I understand you're having a local fire, your own fire preparedness and building. You're going to rebuild.
Yeah, we're thinking of rebuilding. Of course, that all has to go along with brand new building codes and such. So we'll have to have sprinklers and all kinds of stuff like that. So maybe that would help in the future. I don't know.
Yeah.
Probably not having as many wooden decks, maybe building more with concrete, maybe having a metal roof. All of that stuff would certainly help.
Are the insurance companies covering this?
Well, that's a whole other discussion topic right there. We should probably have a whole other show about that. Insurance companies are never your friend, and our goal is to get as much of your policy money out as you possibly can, and that's the fight.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. We'll do another show on that. And you said a local fire preparedness. Are you creating your own fire department up there or what?
Well, that was one of the things we were tossing around, maybe getting some old equipment or something like that. I don't think it would have really helped in this particular fire, but I think for smaller ones, it would absolutely be a good idea.
So our more decentralized fire preparedness makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
Okay, very good. Well, Jeff, thanks so much for being our guest today. Really appreciate that. And
thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for stopping us on the road the other day.
No problem.
All right. Keep us posted of any evolution, though. We'd like to keep covering it.
All righty.
Okay,
will
thanks.
Do.
Okay, take care. Bye for now. And thank you, folks, for listening to the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show. See you next week. Thanks, Bobby, for being there.
Yeah.